Today, Pete is going to tell us more about his autobiography, Pete Jones.
I appreciate this turnout. I think everybody should write an autobiography. I don't mean they should publish it. They should write it, because there is something unusual and unique about every person that is not included in others. This one is called, at the present time, From Southwest Georgia to Cleveland, an autobiography by William Powell Jones. Now, does not mean that that is the title that I'm going to choose. I'm open to suggestions from any of you. This autobiography began in November 1945, when I had just been home a week after nearly 3 years in the Army. I relaxed and grubbed out 4-year-old wild cherries from the pear orchard. I was then ready to begin what I had vowed to do as soon as I got out of the Army, namely to write all I could remember on my early life in Georgia and to give a copy to each of my children. I then had 3 sons, but a 4th one, Nicholas Root, now editor of these papers, have you know that? Editor of these papers and a professor of English at Oberlin College, was already our post-war plans and soon would be ready to take his place with the other 3. Their mother's Ohio is with them every day, but the Georgia of my childhood comes to them only as a strange land where they occasionally go visiting. In 1951, I had 27 pages of these memories of Georgia's childhood mimeographed and stitched for circulation in 50 copies, which I gave to close friends who told me that it was the best thing I had written. That's always a wonderful thing for an author to hear. This was music to my ears, and I vowed to finish it when I was free to do so. That is how I tackled it after I had finished my last scholarly work, a treatise on gentlemen scientists of the 17th and 18th centuries in England and America. That book is still making the rounds, not finding a suitable publisher with the best efforts of Howard Allen and Margaret Henning. I've given 2 or 3 chapters of the book over the years to Rofan Club. Now that is in limbo. I tackled a big job and have gone on right on through with it. This is the story of my graduate school days. I've already given you the memories of my childhood and the experiences in Japan and China. And this is the continuation of that. Story of my graduate school days, of my early years at Delbert College, and of my marriage to Marion Ginn, the daughter of Frank Hadley Ginn, one of Cleveland's most successful corporate lawyers, an early member of Rofan Club, and twice its president, a fact that meant little to me in those early days in Cleveland. I took cognizance of my early friends in Cleveland, which I remembered well, including Sidney Vincent, who's sitting here, and of my early trips, on most of which I took careful notes. The early trips out west, including my first sabbatical taken at Huntington Library in Pasadena, when Hitler's invasion of Europe precluded a planned trip to the British Museum. And my later trips to Europe in 1956, and to Egypt in 1967, around the world and to India in 1970 and 72 with my fellow Rofander, George Bickford. After I had everything in chronological order, I found that I had left out the most important part, the reason for taking over the responsibility of a large place. 4 boys learning to work and to do things for themselves. So I devoted a chapter to each of the boys coming up. of his triumphs and his shortcomings. Then I began to perceive who was the one who managed everything. I voted a chapter to her, to my wife. In between, I put the story of the house, how it shrunk from to one-fourth its beginnings, and then began expanding and changing. The greatest of these changes were in our art collection, how we finally disposed of most of the fine impressionist paintings Mr. Ginn had assembled, how we replaced them with the prints of the Cleveland Print Club, with paintings of Cleveland artists, and with Japanese and Indian paintings and prints. This is how my autobiography grew over the years to its present form. When Nick and I sat down and started to assemble it, we took the chapters chronologically as far as we could, and then added the story of how our house developed, reaching a climax in the poems I wrote to my wife over the years, a proper ending of my life. At that point, as I take up some portions of the autobiography itself, first one from that you may have remember hearing last time I was here, but which is a necessary prelude to what I'm going to talk about, the religious influences of my early life. Most exciting, this is the fun part. The most exciting part of our family religious life was going over every summer for many years to the two-week camp meeting in Indian Springs. Papa and Mama helped run the big hotel, and that was a big job even for their smooth-running team. Every year in August, people of the church gathered at the campgrounds near Indian Springs from all over Georgia and other states for 2 weeks of high-pressure evangelistic services. In the huge tabernacle open at the sides, services of some kind were being held all day from sunrise till midnight. At least three times a day, fiery sermons were preached to packed audiences, and thousands were exhorted to hit the glory trail down the aisles carpeted with straw or sawdust down to the altar rail near the pulpit. Most of the people who came every year in camp meeting had their own summer cottages or rented one. But for a few others, there was a large hotel, a rambling three-story building of unpainted pine. The hotel was run by Brother Myers, and for many years, Papa went regularly to help him. Mama went to help Papa, and we children went for the ride, for we were too little to help much. All we got out of it was our expenses, but the trouble was more than compensated for Mama and Papa by the privilege of occasionally attending the meetings, and for us children by the excitement of it all. Until I was almost 12, it was a high point of every summer to go to Indian Springs. I found it very exciting. The train ride, the local day coach with coal smoke and cinders and three places to change over. The basket lunch on the train. The 3 mile ride from Jackson, the last stop on the main line to the campground on a miniature railroad known as the Dummy, with its tiny engine and the small open cars, the crowds of people at the campground, and the occasional trip to the fashionable hotel and casino at the nearby resort of Indian Springs. I was too young, even in the last few years we went, to be much impressed by the fiery exhorting of the preachers or by the emotional pleas of the workers. But I remember there was much praying, not only at the large semicircular altar rail near the pulpit, but also in the benches where mourners knelt all over the tabernacle, and in the rooms of cottages around the grounds. But I loved the crowds and the air of excitement, the festive music that poured from the huge improvised orchestra and choir on the platform behind the pulpit, and most of all, the circus atmosphere of the tabernacle with its open sides, its straw-filled aisles, and at night, it's flaring gas torches. And I love the good food that Mama and Mrs. Myers provided for the hotel guests. At noon, the tables would overflow and be reset and again overflow. And even with the help of dozens of cooks and waitresses and dishwashers, the place was a madhouse from about 12 to 2 every day. Food was plentiful, and the guests were numerous and hungry. Never before or since have I seen such eating, not even at a family reunion. In the early morning, the farmers used to come to the hotel from every nearby farm with their wagons piled high with vegetables and fruit, and wire coops filled with live chickens. As I remember, the hotels served fried chicken every day for the 2 weeks of the camp meeting. At any rate, there was scarcely a morning that the chickens were not being killed and pecked and got ready for the noon dinner. Table after table of hungry people were fed, and still they came. They ate fried chickens with the same zest that they listened to them preaching and praying, and when they went away, they were no longer hungry. To a child's eye, these people were, most of them, lovable and kind people, not strange religious freaks. They loved a good time and excitement like other people, but during camp meeting, religion was their excitement. I say that is a necessary introduction to what I'm going to tell you now, which you haven't heard because it was not printed, it had never been printed. That is that the effect of this on a college student. My first year was spent at Meridian College, which was a holiness institution. At least twice a year, we had a two-week series of revival meetings. And I defy anyone as young and inexperienced as I was to go through one of them unmoved. After a time, I discovered that it saved a great deal of time, a scar, wear and tear on the emotions, to line yourself up with the good crowd. This was easily done by joining in the first call that was made for a profession of faith, standing up with all those who profess themselves as already saved. It's true that such open profession involved some danger, for you were then expected to take an active part in special prayer meetings and exhorting others to be saved. Many times I've seen workers at the altar rail pray with sinners for hours, pleading with them to renounce their evil ways and give themselves up to God. And for that sort of work, I had no talent or desire. I was usually accepted as one of the passive majority who were content to be saved without becoming zealous workers. There's one thing that continued to bother me, however, and that was the meaning of the second blessing. You read about born again in recent time. Second blessing, which the revival was expected to bring those who at the outset were already numbered among the saved. I gathered it was supposed to be similar to the Pentecost in the New Testament, where the Holy Ghost descended from the disciples in the upper room. But I finally decided that the second blessing was not meant for me. 2 weeks after the revivals were over, I had quit going to prayer meetings and had generally subsided. In technical language, I backslid into my usual sinful state. The next one you've not heard either is the between my freshman and sophomore year of the summer, when I went to help build the largest power plant in the world. The summer between leaving Meridian and entering Emory, I spent helping to build and operate the gigantic power plant that the DuPonts were developing for government near Nashville, Tennessee. Some of the boys from school had already gone up and were making what sounded like fabulous money to me. Well, I was only 16. I got my parents' consent with a little more than train fare in my pocket. I set out for the distant city. If I had realized what I was in for, I would never have gone. But I wouldn't take anything for the experience of that summer. In the first place, by the time I got there, the jobs that college boys of my age could do, my friends were all rodmen, is a technical term used for a surveying gang. Rodmen and surveying gangs were gone, and I was too young to work at a grown man's job. Day after day, the employment office of the plant, which was in Nashville, 15 miles from where the plant was being built, turned me down. Day after day, I went back. My money was running out, even though I was paying only 75 cents a night for the dormitory bed at the YMCA. Finally, the employment office got tired of having me come around and gave me a card to the personnel office at the plant. I boarded the train, went out 16 miles to Great Bend of the Cumberland River, where the old Hickory plant was even then, June 1918, being built, fast realizing its aim of being the largest powder plant in the world. I was thrilled by the beehive activity of the place, elated at the prospect of becoming a part of such a gigantic construction project. I took my place in line at the plant employment office, the manager's desk, took my card, which listed me as common laborer, looked me up and down, and shook his head. What I thought was a job was merely a pass to the plant's employment office. Bitterly disappointed and dejected, I left the building. When I looked around outside, I suddenly realized I was at least inside the plant now, and that nobody had knew whether I was a worker or not. I kept the card and looked up my friends from school. When the boys came in from work that night, they welcomed me. I tell you, I was never so glad to see friendly faces. They made me take off my good suit of clothes, put on the roughest looking things I had with me. They knew men. I went through the same lines as the day before, handed the clerk my card, and was immediately given an assignment to a certain labor gang. By instruction from my friends, I never reported where I was assigned, but went instead to the surveyor party they worked with. They introduced me to a surveyor who needed another hand. Every day I worked as a rodman with the surveying party, had my work card signed by the foreman of the nearby laboring gang. No one ever questioned my status, so I was paid laborer's wages, which for a boy were good. 30 cents an hour with time and a half for overtime over 8 hours a day and double time for Sundays. Since we worked 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, I received pay for 8 days of 11 hours each, which amounted to $26.40 a week, and that was big money for a 16-year-old in the South in those days. I earned it, for I became a good rodman. I even learned the simpler instrument work. My duties as rodman were to hold the surveying rod straight, upright, obey the surveyor's signals until the rod was in perfect line, drive stakes at the proper spots, and hold the chain for measuring distances. Within a month or so, I could not only run a straight line with the instruments, but also plot a profile showing the relative heights and intervals along the line. By that time, my first operating unit, the old Hickory, was making smokeless powder. I asked to be transferred to the operating department. My surveyor boss was furious, and I don't blame him. They had trained me to be an expert rodman, and now I wanted to go into something I knew nothing about, the making of powder. But in those days, I was greedy for experience. I wanted to do a little everything, just to see how they did it. Now, the reason is I already knew all there was to learn about being a rodman. Besides, I could get 52 cents an hour, so I transferred and worked for a month or so before I had to go back to school. But I never made powder, merely worked near the shed where it was made. For ironically, my job in the operating department was watching a fire plug. That summer at the powder plant was an amazing experience in more ways than one. It opened my eyes to the world of commerce, feverish with its emergency haste of construction, gigantic in its plans for 9 huge operating units, and wasteful in its every move. I saw the battery of tremendous brick stacks rise into the sky, and the smoke pour from them to make steam for a central powder plant. My roommate, Ralph Beeson, one of the son of the president of Meridian College, stoked one of the numerous furnaces. Coming home at night with only his eyes showing white, Ralph would tell me about the large poking rods, the white heat of his furnace, and I was all the more impressed with the grandiose scheme of the plan. I helped stake off miles of pipelines designed to convey this steam to the distant units. I saw many of them actually built, great steel pipes laid on immense modern scaffolding. I saw the concrete being poured around us, even as we were surveying new lines. Great gobs of concrete sliding down from towers to the wooden forms where steel ribs poked out. I saw the great acid plants with their mountainous vats of boiling acid, in one of which it was said a workman had fallen and instantly just disappeared without trace. I saw the great piles of sulfur, smelled the yellowish acrid fume from the plants. Twice a day, to and from work, I rode by these great mills. That is, I rode when I could hitch a ride on a passing truck and walk to a few of them. I learned a lot about that summer about men, too. I went to Nashville from the sheltered life, religious surroundings, to a madhouse where the riffraff of the world had gathered. I listened to men whose ordinary language seemed to consist largely of foul talk, profane oaths I had never known existed. On the other hand, I learned how to get around on my own, what it was like to have no money and no hope of getting it. And again, what it was like to have plenty, or what seemed to me then like plenty. I saved about $200 from the summer's work, and so when I went to Emory that fall, I could join a fraternity and do some of the other things I could not ordinarily have done. The next episode was a very different one, was also taking the best chances I had for work during the summer. This was to top work pecan trees. In case you don't know what top work in pecan trees is, I'll tell you later. These people had heard of my, this was in the big plantation of the American Sumatra Tobacco Company, which is one of the largest growers of shade tobacco in the world. They had two outfits, one near in the Connecticut River Valley and the other in the small area around Quincy, Florida. That's where I was, Quincy, Florida. I was glad they had to say that they had, I had held out for $18 a week in all expenses, which by many big money, since it was all clear profit, and since I was afraid, since I was paid when whether I was able to work or not. Well, I didn't learn doing much about top working for the first 3 weeks because it rained nearly every day. But I did learn a lot about shade tobacco and how it grows, comes into cigar wrappers. That's what it's made for. This kind of special leaf tobacco is grown under lattice shade and in a certain kind of soil that apparently exists in the United States only in the Connecticut River Valley and in a few square miles around Quincy, Florida. It must be cured in large barns with long wooden windows that open up for ventilation. The tremendous leaves are strung on sticks about a yard long. And these sticks are hung in tiers up to the high roof of the barn. They are cured slowly and with the aid of small fires, and then taken down and packed away in wooden cases. During the whole process and until the leaf is used as a cigar wrapper, it must be kept moist, or as they say, kept in case. I loved the look at the smooth brown texture of the leaves. When stretched across my hand, they looked like brown silk. When the rain stopped, the budding was easy, because they had if old trees are cut properly, top working is very little different from ground budding, which I was an expert at by that time. The only difference is that you are putting the bud into tender sprouts instead of natural wood, matured wood. So you have to be particularly careful not to cut deep into the wood. As it was, the first grove I had not been cut properly. Not enough old limbs had been left to prevent a profusion of brittle sprouts. We couldn't wait, and so I did the best I could after the rain stopped. I was not proud of my work. I was glad when I had finished and could move on to the next plantation on the other side of town. Well, one experience from my Emory days, about my ambition to become a great sportsman. Studies came fairly easily to me. After I learned to make friends with the non-fraternity men, it was not too hard to get elected to positions that I was incapable of filling. But I had never been good at sports. Then as now, Emory was allowed to participate in no intercollegiate athletics. Whether you knew that or not, but it long ago gave up intercollegiate athletics. The only one they had was track, which I went out for. I went out for track and got into this most grueling of all events, the mile run. All winter we trained for the one big meet against Georgia Tech. Part of the training was with the cross-country team that jogged over the hills on these cold days, clad in long underwear. Our competition was 4 miles on a loop going as far as Ponce de Leon Avenue and back. The day we ran in the big meet, I thought I would never make it around those 4 miles, but I did. I came in about 12th, and I should have been in the first four. But I couldn't understand why, until at the hospital that night, my brother, who was an intern at the hospital, looked at my jaw and saw that it was full of pus. He stuck a needle in and it spurted out. Coach was so determined to win this event that he encouraged me to stay on, and it's in the mile, to help the other man win. I was not expected to win, but I was expected to pace the first quarter mile in fast time, and if possible to get the chief opponent boxed up or off his stride in some way. So for 2 years, Emory won the mile, but I was never in the money. Fortunately for me, the coach recognized my contribution, and in my senior year, I got my letter in track. For years, I wore the big yellow E on my dark blue sweater to prove that I was good in a line that I was never fitted for. My last part I'm going to read to you is a very short one. It's about my decision to become a college professor. It was not a decision so much as a recognition that I was not fit for anything else. What I should do myself after 4 years in college and 2.5 years of traveling came as no decision, but as a sort of resting place, inevitable, an elimination of things to do rather than a decision to become a great teacher. I just drifted into graduate work after having gone through all the professions one by one during my stay in Japan. Incidentally, those who think that you have to be ready to do something when you go to college is foolish, because I was not even ready after I left college to do anything. Theology was eliminated first. And then that was before I became a member of the Episcopal Church. Carter and I have both come up through he from the Presbyterian and I from the Methodist Church into the Episcopalian, and we are probably more Episcopalian than any of the people out there. Theology was eliminated first, for it was my supposed destiny from a baptismal service where the minister had prophetically christened me Bishop Powell Jones instead of William Powell Jones. I'd hesitated over medicine in no uncertain terms because my older brother Walter, whom I idolized, had already become a doctor. I wanted to follow him and even change my courses with the idea of pre-medical training to biology and chemistry and physics in my senior year. All I lacked was organic chemistry, and that could easily be made up in those days. When my brother was interned at Grady Hospital in Atlanta, I used to watch him in his trials at the hospital, skillfully delivering 2 babies by himself, while a third one was botched by having his baby come too fast when he was watching someone else do it. Then I met my test and a simple spinal puncture. I don't know whether you know what a spinal puncture is, but it certainly is bad when you have to watch it. Where my sympathies followed the needle too closely, and I keeled over. Law I could not bear. Business I had no ties with. That brought me to teaching in a direct line. For teaching and study went together. Jimmy Hinton, my old English teacher, was ready for me when I got down to Emory. I was too late to enter Harvard. The University of Chicago would open its regular winter session in January. I could make up for my poor English major by extra work in 2 quarters. It all seemed so simple that I just fell in with it. And that is how I found myself going to Chicago after a brief spell in the sun in Georgia. That is how I decided to teach, because I wanted to be in a profession where I could go on studying and learning until I had my pill. I have more, but that is enough for today, I think. And I was going to tell you about the times how I got my genealogical interest and how I went for that in my autobiography, the last of all. But incidentally, this is the way in which I did it best. It was Dan Levin who encouraged me to add poems that I'd left out during the years, thereby to ensure that most of my poems, which were not good enough to be published in my lifetime, would be put into context. Here's a sample from verses to my father that led to my interest in genealogy. Welshman leaving Virginia, the settled land. Salzburg Austrians leaving the Georgia coast to beat off the wolves and the Indians. Make fields where fine pine forests grew. They stare at us now from tintypes, stiff, austere, and so on and so on. That is part of the beginning of my autobiography. When are you going to write yours?